Hello. Good afternoon. My name's Bridget Fitzgerald. You're listening to The Country Hour. I hope that you're well on this Monday, enjoying the start to the school holidays. You might have received a little bit of rain. We just heard in the news there that there's some severe weather warnings going on across the south of the state and some areas in flood. So do take care. But I do know that others of you, probably further up to the northern agricultural region, might be celebrating a little bit of rain after a few weeks of dry weather. You can let me know on 0448 922 604 if that's you, if you are indeed happy and maybe did an effective rain dance over the weekend. And I'm also wondering today, school holidays, of course, in September, means Perth Royal Show time. Do you still go? Do you like to head to the show? Perhaps you show off your animals or some fleece or handicrafts and things like that. But I'm wondering if it has in fact become less agricultural. Is the Perth Royal Show still an agricultural show? That's what I want to hear from you today. You can send me a text on 0448 922 604. We've been out this morning asking that question down at the show.
I've been coming here for approximately 20-odd years, and even on today's like today, we still have a lot of fun, and it's about comradeship and friends that you don't see for years in the cattle lanes, and it's great to catch up. It's not all about competition, it's all about people and friends.
Do you think the purpose has changed at all over the last 20 years?
Definitely has. It definitely has. There's a lot less, it's more on the less rural side of it is shown. It's more of the sideshow alley, you know, it's got very much commercial rather than on the rural side of it.
Is the Perth Royal Show still an agricultural show? You can let me know what you think on 0448 922 604. Of course, it kicked off over the weekend, and unfortunately it has been another wet year for the show. A bit rainy and stormy out there today. Our reporter Tyne Logan is braving the elements there for us today. How are things looking there, Tyne?
Hey, Bridget, I'm at the Royal Show and it is so cold and it's so rainy, and I'd never want to wish away the rain, but the cattle yards here are looking incredibly muddy at the moment. Now, you may be able to hear in the background, but I am at the Lead Steer and Heifer Cattle Auction. It's the only auction for the show, but it's also part of a competition, a bit of a double-barreled competition where the cattle is judged on their presentation, and then once sold, they also go into a carcass competition. Now, this season, prices aren't expected to be quite as good as previous years, and that's because the cattle price has come off a little bit. And also, it's been a pretty tough season, but I'll give you the wrap a bit later on, see how what's meant to be the best of the best of WA's cattle has sold this year.
Thanks, Tyne. We'll check back in with Tyne Logan a little bit later in the program. But as I said, want to know from you today if the Perth Show still means an agricultural show to you. Do you still go along? Does it still have that rural and farming element? 0448 922 604. Well, as Tyne just mentioned, the rain is not that pleasant for those who have travelled particularly quite some way to get to the Royal Show this week, but it is going to be useful for some of the later sown crops for growers in the northern ag region. We'll run through all the rainfall figures after the weather at 12:30 today, but first, Sean Kalajic farms at Cadoo. We actually heard from Sean a few weeks ago when he was explaining how he's experienced a very dry start to the year, as I know many of you have as well. Sean, how much rain have you had in the past few days?
Since Thursday afternoon, we've had about 16.5 mils spread across all of our properties.
And how much have you had in the weeks prior to that?
We haven't had any rain for over 5 weeks. We missed out on the rain that was supposed to come for the downfield days, so things were looking extremely dry.
Will this make much of a difference?
This rain will definitely make a huge difference. Anything that was still hasn't thrown a head up yet will finish all them off nicely, and everything that is out in head will just fill it out nicely. So it's definitely sort of secured a bit more of a favourable finish for us, considering.
Now, Sean, I spoke to you a few weeks ago when I think you were in a similar position, having had a pretty dry start and had a bit of a sprinkle of rain, which obviously kind of stopped for the few weeks after that. What have you got in the ground at the moment?
We've stuck with our normal rotation. We've still got our wheat, canola, barley, lupins, and everything is out of the ground. Probably 20% of it is very below average and struggling, but this will definitely help with the rest of it.
What kind of an effect do you think it will have on your yields?
We're hoping that this will now help us break even. It wasn't looking that good for a while. We were sort of starting to assess which crops we'd have to spray out, which we've still got to spray out some, but we're definitely very happy with what we actually do have, considering the season and how little rain we had. You don't have to go very far away from us and they've still got pretty much nothing, so we feel very blessed in that aspect.
And what have you heard from people, not just around you, but, you know, from right across the region over those past few days? Has there been reasonably widespread rainfall?
I think it has been fairly widespread. Sadly, from north of us, it's probably come, well, very much too late for them, but anywhere south of us, it'll definitely help everyone out. It is good to see, though, that everyone's getting a little bit of it.
Sean Kalajic, thanks so much for your time on the Country Hour. He farms at Cadoo and he runs a cropping operation at about 5,500 hectares. Interestingly, Sean's comment there that he doesn't know whether this rain over the past few days will make much of a difference to those who are north of him at Cadoo, so perhaps around that Dalwallinu kind of area, Killarney as well. But if you're listening and you are in that zone and you think that things will still be helpful, this rain will still be helpful to you this season, let me know. 0448 922 604. As I said, we'll run through the total rainfall right across the state after the weather at 12:30. Although, notwithstanding this latest rain, it has been a particularly dry year. Although the consensus is that it's definitely not as bad as the drought in 06 and 07. Instead, many growers and agronomists are in agreement that it's quite similar to the dry year in 2002. So what exactly have growers learned in those past 15 years? Lucinda Jose asked agronomist Simon Teagle what he thought.
I know a couple of growers who've suggested to me that 02 is the most comparable year as well, yet they're going to grow more grain than what they did in 02. And I think a lot to do with that has been our farming practice. So, you know, things like summer rain. So the majority of growers now, when we get summer rain, within a couple of weeks, they're making sure that they spray out their summer weeds and they conserve moisture. So, you know, that has a big bearing. If you can germinate a crop at any time of the year, and if you have a couple of dry spells, well, you know that there is some moisture conserved in the soil profile, so they'll be able to, you know, carry through those drier areas or drier periods of the year a lot better. So that's one thing. Secondly, since 02, so we're talking 15 years ago, lime. I mean, a lot of people hadn't done any liming back in, you know, those early 2000s. Now, you know, there's not many growers who haven't done a lot of lime. And when I say lime too, there's other, you know, your soil amendments of dolomite and gypsum that growers are now doing depending on the soil type and the soil characteristics. So that's had a huge bearing. And then thirdly, I think, you know, just our general agronomy has gotten a lot better. So as in varieties, time of sowing, more timely weed control, better fertiliser strategies, machinery, you know, precision machinery now. I know a lot of growers this year who have, you know, sown their wheat, well, most of their crops quite deep to hit the subsoil moisture that was conserved over the summer and managed to germinate a crop. So that's made a huge difference. You know, there's a lot of things that have changed over the last 15 years that have helped growers grow more grain on a drier year.
Do you think, in general, we're better farmers now?
Oh, definitely. You know, you used to see a lot of paddocks that used to blow away because they were possibly overgrazed or there wasn't any ground cover. And, you know, you'd see it at certain times of the year where summer weeds, you know, melons would be as big as a car. And, you know, you just don't see things like that anywhere near as much as what you used to. And I think growers have become a lot better at realising that, yep, we've got to go and do something now, and they go and get stuck into it. So, you know, and that's happened a lot this year, you know, like especially through where I do a lot of work in Moira and Perindri, you know, we've inspected paddocks 4 and 5 times this year for spraying for weeds and gone, no, we better wait for another decent rain. You know, we better wait for another decent rain. Of course, that's gone on for a couple of months. And, you know, obviously through late July, early August, it's like, oh, we better go and spray that, because they actually are, you know, instead of not harvesting the crop, we'll harvest the crop. So, and then they do, they just get stuck straight into it. So I think growers have definitely become better at making sure that when it's time to do something, they just get stuck straight into it.
And in terms of making those decisions in a timely way, would you say that growers are also handling this dry season in a different way, sort of emotionally and socially? I know it's not your area of expertise.
No. Oh, look, I think we'll all agree that the last 8 weeks, and for some areas possibly the last 10 weeks, you know, has certainly changed the mood of growers, because, you know, we've had a lot of rain over the last 6 to 10 weeks. And that's made a huge difference to, one, the financial stress that's going to be, you know, because some growers will lose money this year, and I mean, there's other growers that will you know, turn a fairly good profit. But the damage that was possibly going to happen, you know, is not going to happen. But, you know, like I say, there's still growers that'll lose money. So that obviously, the last sort of 6 to 10 weeks has made a huge difference to that. But I think I'd have to say that, you know, probably very early on in the year, there's quite a lot of negativity about the season being like 06 and 07, and I did happen to walk out of a meeting that people thought we were talking about 06 and 07. I think that was a very, very negative attitude, and I think this year proves that if you maintain a positive attitude, things actually can turn around. And I know it doesn't happen all the time, but certainly by maintaining a positive attitude and trying to make as much out of every situation you get, and maintaining that focus on that, certainly pays dividends. Because for anyone that decided to tuck their hands up and, well, I'm not going to worry about anything more for the rest of the year, that's probably going to cost them very dearly this year. And the growers that maintain a positive attitude and kept, every time a rainfall event happened and it changed the situation, they said, righto, what have we got to do to make some more money? That's I think this year proves that that's what you need to do.
And you think that's the lesson that will come out of this year?
Well, I do. I mean, like I say, I feel for the growers that are in that northeastern fringe that, you know, majority of them will go backwards, and they'll go backwards less than what they were going to go backwards 6 to 8 weeks ago. But the lesson is that you should never, ever throw the baby out with the bathwater, I think is really what the lesson is, because I think the old saying is if you're going to farm for a drought, you're actually never going to make any money. And that's been that saying is being said at many a field day and many a meeting from time to time. And, you just have to maintain a positive attitude, because things can turn around, and they certainly have this year for a lot of growers.
Simon Teagle from Full Flag Agronomy speaking there with Lucinda Jose. Comparisons about this year being quite similar to the 2002 season, but we have come a long way in 15 years, which is always great to hear. Up north now, environmental groups have launched a campaign against a proposed irrigation development on Gogo Station in the Kimberley, claiming the project could do irreversible damage to the Fitzroy River. As we've heard on the Country Hour before, Gogo is planning to grow around 5,000 hectares of fodder crops for its cattle and is currently seeking the necessary approvals from government. The campaign against this proposal, led by Broome-based Environs Kimberley, says Gogo's plan to draw water into large storage dams makes no sense and contradicts government plans to create the Fitzroy River National Park. Matt Brann reports.
Gogo Station near Fitzroy Crossing has been growing irrigated sorghum for its cattle using 2 centre pivots for several years now and is seeking approvals to expand. It wants to harvest flood water from a small tributary called Blue Bush Creek, extracting up to 50 gigalitres a year if the wet season is strong enough. Gogo's development manager, Phil Hams, spoke to the ABC last month and said irrigated fodder could transform the local cattle industry.
One of the drivers of this is that smallish operation out there with the 2 pivots and a certain amount of dryland cropping has encouraged us to keep moving ahead, because it works. Having that capacity to hold cattle and take pressure off rangelands, particularly when you're processing cattle, it works. There's no question about that. I think, sadly, that WA hasn't utilised its land and water assets, and I'm not talking about overdoing, I'm talking about modest utilisation of land and water assets to enhance the cattle industry.
Phil Hams describes the GoGo proposal as a modest use of water resources, but green groups disagree. In its petition against the proposal, an alliance of environmental groups claim the project could do irreversible damage. Jason Fowler is from Environs Kimberley.
Well, the biggest concern really is that GoGo Station want to clear up to 9,000 hectares of land adjacent to the Margaret River and Blue Bush Creek, which is next to Fitzroy Crossing. They want to build a 40 gigalitre water storage dam and then a second dam, which is a 7.2 gigalitre water storage dam. Just to put this into context, the Broome, township of Broome, which has at least 15,000 people, uses 6 gigalitres per year. So you're talking about six or seven times the water usage of the whole town of Broome just in these water storage dams. And their idea is to build a big canal and put in big levee banks and harvest all the floodwater off the Margaret River and Mount Pierre Creek. So the volumes they're talking about are absolutely enormous.
Yeah, so it's our understanding that GoGo are looking to capture this floodwater from when it's flowing about 3 metres above what it normally flows on at the Margaret River, and then pump this into a storage dam. So this is a bit different from pumping water directly from the river, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're exactly right. That's exactly what they're proposing to do. So our big concern is that the floodwaters in the Fitzroy River are absolutely critical to the health of the river. Those floodwaters only happen every 3, 4, or 5 years. So they don't happen every year. Most of the time that river is fairly dry with only perennial or small pools or wetlands. These are called refuge pools. So most of the time all the animals are concentrated in these small refuge pools. Now what happens if you harvest all the floodwater off the river? The floodwaters are critical because they recharge all the aquifers down the river. And these aquifers supply the refuge pools right throughout the dry season. So the aquifers dry out, the refuge pools dry out, all the animals die.
That's Jason Fowler from Environs Kimberley speaking to Oliver Gordon. In the Kimberley last week for the region's economic forum, Ag Minister Alana McTiernan said she was not aware of the environmental push against GoGo Station, but said the government was keen to let the cattle industry push forward in a sustainable way.
I mean, obviously, there are going to always be some profoundly competing views on these sorts of issues. Now, we've made the big decision that there is no way that we're going to dam the Fitzroy, for example, but we have said that that does mean that we will be required to be using various groundwater sources in order to give effect to enable the industry to go forward. But I would need to see, I mean, I haven't seen the case that the environmentalists are putting forward. But obviously we've got to look at all of these things seriously and make a decision.
That's Agriculture Minister Alana McTiernan ending that report from Matt Brann. And Phil Hams from GoGo Station says the company is not prepared to comment on the environmental campaign at this stage, but you can read more about the GoGo proposal up online right now if you search for WA Country Hour. Asking for your thoughts today on 0448 922 604, if the Perth Royal Show is still an agricultural show, is there still enough focus on farming and animals and production, and is that why you go along? 0448 922 604.
Originally, a lot of farmers came to Perth and had their holidays here and to look at our bulls and our stock. Now you don't see many farmers coming at all.
Does that speak to you? 0448 922 604. We'll be crossing back to the Perth Royal Show after the weather and rainfall at 12:30. Right now, though, it's 25 past 12. You're listening to The Country Hour. You're with me, Bridget Fitzgerald. and a study by the Australian National University identifying possible sites for pumped hydro energy systems could open up some opportunities for farmers. The study found 22,000 places around the country where electricity could be generated by water, including 3,800 sites here in WA. The ANU study was partly funded by the Australian Renewable Energy Agency, and it's got a goal of cheap and secure national electricity grid that's 100% powered by renewables. As David Claughton reports, hydro-pumped energy storage systems work best in conjunction with wind and solar power systems.
The idea of generating power from pumped hydro has been around ever since construction started on the Snowy Hydro Scheme, but the expansion of wind and solar farms around the country makes it much more feasible today. Brad Smith from the New South Wales Nature Conservation Council is excited by the idea.
If we just use one out of every 200 of those sites, that'll provide all the dispatchable and storage that our grid needs, and so we can completely move away from coal and gas and those energy sources that are polluting and harming the climate. So it's a really exciting study, and we think it shows the end of burning coal, which can't come soon enough.
Farmers could use pumped hydro to generate income in dry times. Miners and energy companies are wondering if old mine sites and power stations could be used for hydro. Adelaide-based Zen Energy says they have big plans for new renewable energy projects in Whyalla and are looking at installing solar and using depleted iron ore mines for storage. Power company AGL is looking at pumped hydro to replace its Liddell power plant in New South Wales. That includes altering the neighbouring man-made lake and nearby disused mines to allow for pumped hydro power. So how does it work, and why is renewable power important? Professor Andrew Blakers from the ANU explained it to Madeline Lewis.
Off-river pumped hydro entails building two reservoirs, basically oversized farm dams, one at the top of a high hill and the other at the bottom. You connect the two with a pipe, which might be 2 or 3 kilometres long, and water oscillates backwards and forwards, going from the lower to the upper reservoir when there's excess solar and wind that's pumped uphill. And when you want that electricity back again, the water comes back down through the pipe, through the turbine, to recreate the electricity. Preferably the height difference between the upper and lower reservoirs is in the range 400 or 500 metres or more, because when you double the height difference between the reservoirs, you double the energy and power capacity of the reservoirs, but you don't double the cost.
Areas with mountain, wind or solar power are best.
When you can find all three together, then you can develop, for example, a renewable energy precinct, which would have lots of wind, lots of solar photovoltaics and some pumped hydro, and a strong interconnector to the high voltage network so that you can get that power to the cities where it's mostly used.
So is it effectively in the government's court now that they have this information?
It's not just government, of course. There's plenty of commercial players who have to be involved. Importantly, the government can assist by changing the energy market rules to encourage storage. There's some notable impediments, and the Snowy 2.0 suffers from those impediments as well, in that the value of storage is not properly rewarded in the market. So the government, for example, could get behind one or two of these systems in order to get them up and running before Liddell and some of the other big coal power stations shut in the early 2020s. Or it could simply change the rules and also facilitate fast-tracking of some of the best of these systems.
Brad Smith from the Nature Conservation Council told Pablo Vinales why it could work well on farms.
Any farmer who's got land that has a shallow gully up high in the country, which makes it ideal for storing energy with pumped hydro. And also it can be a closed-loop system. So when power is available, so let's say it's windy at night or maybe in the middle of the day when there's lots of solar power, you can cheaply push the water from the lower reservoir up to the top of the hill. And then when you need the power, maybe in the evening when people are cooking dinner and turning on their lights, then you can run the power back down the hill to generate electricity. So that the water is just moving around in a closed loop system. So once you've got the water in the system, there's no need to keep topping it up. And so even, you know, during droughts or in dry areas, this technology is still appropriate.
And you think special attention will be needed in areas that currently rely on coal for employment?
We absolutely need to have a transition plan to make sure that, you know, those workers and those communities who have provided power, you know, aren't the ones who shoulder the burden of this transition. It's something that those communities and us, even as an environment group, are calling for funded transition plans to make sure that no one's left behind.
So how much will all this cost? Well, the ANU says it will have a detailed cost model by the end of the year.
And thank you to David Claughton for that report. And just having a look at the map that ANU released with that report, there are 3,800 locations, as I said, that have been identified as potential pumped hydro sites here in WA, and they're scattered from the Kimberley and the Pilbara down to the southwest region. The report says that while WA is not as mountainous as other regions of Australia, they believe that there's the potential to create 9,000 gigawatt hours of electricity. There you go. In the state. It's 12:30 and Rebecca Dollery joins me in the studio for news headlines.
Thanks, Bridget. Australia's Space Industry Association says a national space agency will provide the country with the centralised leadership it's been lacking. The federal government has announced it will create a national space agency in a bid to capitalise on the $400 billion global industry. The association's chairman says Australia's space industry will now be able to grow quickly. The Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, says the East Coast faces a gas shortage three times worse than expected, but he won't rush into imposing gas export restrictions. The federal government's received two reports into the nation's gas supply today. And the North Korean regime has sent letters to governments around the world condemning US President Donald Trump. North Korean state media says the letters have been sent to other countries around the world calling for support in the face of US aggression. The letters say President Trump's speech to the United Nations has increased the chances of nuclear war. Thanks, Bridget. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you so much, Beck Dollery there with the news headlines. Let's cross now to the Weather Bureau. Matt Bodehoven is there today. Hi, Matt.
Yeah, good afternoon.
What can we expect across the Southwest Land Division over the coming days? I can't get my words out today.
Well, that's like me normally. So
no your name, here. Division, it's all very difficult.
Yes. Well, over the next few days, we'll still have a little bit wet weather. On Tuesday, we've got a low-pressure system that's near Perth currently, but over the next 24 hours, it's going to move over the southwest and lie southeast of Esperance late Tuesday. So showers through the division, possible thunderstorms in the central west and adjacent parts. Rain near the south coast with an isolated thunderstorm chance. Could see another good figure, rainfall figure there between Albany and Esperance during tomorrow. Showers will also clear inland areas during the evening. On Wednesday, we have a ridge of high pressure over the Southwest Land Division and a cold front will approach the southwest corner. Showers in the coastal districts extending to inland areas for a period from late morning until mid-afternoon. On Thursday, that weak cold front will move over the Southwest Land Division. Showers about coastal districts extending into the Great Southern and Central Wheat Belt in the afternoon and evening. Thunderstorms possible southwest for line Durian Bay to Ravensthorpe. On Friday, a ridge of high pressure will develop in the wake of the cold front through the Southwest Land Division. Showers in southern parts and some morning showers near the west coast.
And what about for northern and eastern districts there, Matt?
Yeah, on Tuesday we'll see some showers over the West Pilbara, southern and western parts of the Gascoyne, through the Goldfields and in the Eucla. On Wednesday, showers will extend into the northern interior, eastern Pilbara, far southwest Kimberley. Also some showers about the western Gascoyne through the southern Goldfields and Eucla. On Thursday, fairly similar again, showers through the eastern Pilbara and northern interior, also into the southern Goldfields and Eucla, and about the western parts of the Gascoyne. On Friday, showers and possible thunderstorms through the interior. Could see some rainfall figures, some moderate rainfall figures possible. Also some morning showers about the western Gascoyne coastal areas.
And any warnings that you want to just remind us of, Matt?
Yeah, we've got a gale warning for Albany Coast, Esperance Coast, also a strong wind warning for Bunbury Geograph Coast and the Leeuwin Coast. Also have a severe weather warning for areas in the south coastal around the Mount Barker, Albany and Bremer Bay area. We've had some very heavy rainfall over the last 12, 24 hours, so there's some possibility of some flash flooding. So we'll monitor that area, and likely that warning will cease during the afternoon and evening.
Thanks so much.
Cheers.
Matt Bodehoven there with the Weather Bureau. Do remember to take care today if you are out on the roads in those southern areas. Let's run through the rainfall now. In the 72 hours to 9 a.m. this morning, we'll start across the South West Land Division. Through the Central West, Arrowdale had 21 millimetres, Badgingarra 37, Barberton 12, Barberton East 22, Ballandine had 20, Berkshire Valley 19, Bindi East had 12 millimetres over 4 days, but the north had 17 millimetres. Balgowda had 13, Canterbury with 19, Geraldton Airport had 10, Coolangatta had 9 millimetres, Kalbarri with 6, Carrara with 11, Linton 15, Moasca with 25, Morowa Airport 12, Mullawar with 13, Nambung Station 17, Northampton 35 millimetres, Port Denison 10, Riverside 15, Tabletop had 30, Tarden Hill had 12 millimetres, Tiburton had 21, Woondi had 28, Yandanooka had 22. For the Lower West, Anchortail with 31, Bickley 40, Bindoon 34, Bolgart 7, Bolgart Bin had 18, Bungendore had 36, Chidlow 18, Dwelling Up 24, and Carnett with 18, Carrigullen North 46, Lake Chittering 26, Lancelin had 36, and Mooliabini had 35, Mount Solace with 39, Mushe with 19, Mundaring had 28, Pickering Brook had 20, Pinjarra South had 19, a few other, Rolly Stone had 49, Serpentine with 38, Swanbourne with 53, 2J East 19, Watning 25. For the southwest, Acton Park had 18, Boyan Up North 14, Bridgetown 24, Bunbury 16, Busselton Airport 16, Cape Lewin had 24, Cape Naturalist 28, Capel North 14, Chapman Hill Road had 16, Collie East 15, Quarrumup 23, Dardenup East 13, lots of easts in here getting all the rainfall, Donnybrook had 8 millimetres, Donnybrook East had 13, Doyle Road with 17, Ferguson Valley 1 Ferguson Valley had 9 and 1 Ferguson Valley had 8. Still yet to know how to tell the difference. Happy Valley Alert Station 16, Henty Brook 15, Jarrawood 18, Jindong 23, Carey Valley Research Station 15, Ludlow with 13, Manjimup 47, Mount William 26, Newbicup had 6, Northcliffe 24, Paindale Alert Station 12, Perivale Orchard 14, Rowlands 6, Shannon 42, Somme Creek 20, Thompson Brook 13, Vass Highway CB3 16, Warner Glen 10, Windy Harbour 46, Wychcliffe 30, Worsley Downs 9, Yungarillup 17, Yordamung Lake with 11. For the southern coastal region, Albany had 34, Albany Airport 68, Amalup had 39, Barrett Meadows 98 millimetres over 5 days, Beaumont West 19, Bremer Bay 35, Chain Beach 70. I think that might even be the winner there. Chillinup 37, Dalyup Park with 11, Denbarker 17, Erinair 14, Esperance 21, Esperance Airport 19, Inglebourne 41, Jacup 27, Jerramungup 6, Kendinup 8, King River 19, Many Peaks 69, Munglinup 9, Munglinup West 17, Narrakup West 10 millimetres, Nalirup had 9 millimetres over 4 days, Oakmarsh Farm with 17, Ongarup 28, Parongarup South 11, Salmongums Research Station 24, Tamar 68, Talena Downs 19, The Duke 23, Warajara had 35, Windrush with 15. For the Central Wheatbelt, Amory Acres had 12, Ardeth 7, Belka 13, Bencubbin 14, Beverley 12, Bodellan South 5, Bonnie Rock 9 millimetres, Bullfinch 13, Bungala 13 millimetres, Kalgi 14, Codgecodgeon 8, Cunderdon Airfield 19, Dalwallinu 11, Dudekline 6, Dungan Peak 6 millimetres, Janding had 7, Gabon 5, Happy Valley 6, Hines Hill 12, Droradine had 19, Corkadine had 10, Condit had 11, Conongoring 6, Long Forest 18, Mount Hardy 17, Mount Noddy 20, Mount Westdale 19, Muckinburden 13, Narrambeen with 13 as well, Northam 17, Quadney 25, Quiriding 14, Redlands 17, Seven Oaks 12, Southern Cross also with 12, as does Swanara have 12, Tamman 7, Tallenning Hill 9, Trining had 5, Wael had 13, Waelke had 5 millimetres, Wongan Hills 7, whereas Wongan Hills North had 13, Woburn with 9, Walcatcham 10, Yangadine 12, York 12, York Rakine with 7. Just bear with me, only a little bit more to go. Great Southern, Amarista Park had 11, Arthur River 7, Badgerbup 37, Bannister 11, Beaumont 22, Boddington North 20, Burley had 10, Boscobel 8, Brookton 23, Bullye 12 millimetres, Chammingup had 36, Colorado 10, Coondee 20, Corrigan 16, Cranbrook 22, Cranham 9, Culford 31, Dalyanine 7, Dumbleyung 8, Franklin 12, Graham Rock 9 millimetres over 4 days, Horseshoe 7, Hyden 8, Katanning Research Station 35, King Rocks 8, Cookerin 10, Lake Grace 12, Maradong 25, Mordetta 13, Narrogin 17, Newdigate Research Station 16, Nyabing 6, Pingerley 18, Pingerup 7, Wagen with 10 millimetres, Wandering with 22, Wilgarra had 29, Williams North 13, Woodenilling 8, and Yealering East had 19 millimetres. As for the northern and eastern districts, only a couple, Gascoyne over 5 millimetres, I should add, Gascoyne region, Denham had 9 millimetres, Mergoo had 5, and Shark Bay Airport had 8. And in the Goldfields, Norseman Airport received 15 millimetres of rainfall. 18 minutes to 1 o'clock.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
You're with me, Bridget Fitzgerald. It's great to be with you on this Monday. And it's a busy day in the cattle yards at the Perth Rural Agricultural Show, with the show's only cattle option having just wrapped up. But this year, prices weren't as strong as some producers might have hoped. The lead steer and heifer auction, lead steer and heifer auction, I should say, is part of a hoof and hook competition where the cattle is judged on presentation as well as carcass. The sale is an opportunity for cattle producers to show off the best genetics they've got, and it often attracts a big premium on what they'd get at a normal sale. But as Dardanup stud breeder Peter Milton told Tyne Logan, this year that premium wasn't really there.
The broad ribbon winners all did very well. The balance of the steers, the rest of the unplaced steers probably made market price, so what we can expect. All the extra work and cost involved in bringing a steer to the show, you don't get rich on it, but it's also part of our life. We like to do it and to show off our product and meet the public.
Now, when you do bring a steer or a heifer to the show, you do expect to probably get a bit of a premium. Why did that not happen this year?
Well, we hope for it. I think everyone will be basically happy with the price. The butchers are there, you know, the buyers do their level best for us at the show. They do cop some bruises, they cop some dark cutters, and they don't complain too much, so we've got to go with the market. It was an auction, and we're used to that.
What did best for you?
Oh, Winston, our Murray Grey. He did very well. $8,000, so that's an all to a great cause.
And in terms of commercial cattle, how'd you go?
The other two steers, we got our money back. Yeah, so it was fine. It was an auction, and we participated, so it was good. It's also, as I say, it's good to be here to meet the public, to explain our industry. It's what we do every year, and we love it.
How do you think this season compares to previous seasons?
The season down home has been real tough for us. It didn't rain for a long time, and when it did, it didn't stop. And the only time it stopped was when we got frost. So where we are, it was a problem. It's been a mixed year in many places. But that's farming again, and we'll be all right.
And when it comes to the overall quality of not just yours, but all the cattle that was entered in the auction today, how do you think they've gone?
I think this is... To my mind, this might be the best lineup of trade steers I've seen at Perth Rural Show. They were terrific. The temperament of all of the cattle was outstanding. the presentation. I know, and I really got to hand it to a lot of the young handlers as well. Their presentation and their skills were second to none. It was a top showing.
So why? I mean, what made that difference?
I can't answer. I really don't know. But it's just an observation. I hadn't really thought of it. The cattle certainly. I think there's more genetics coming, becoming available, and that's great for the industry. But back to the school kids and the ag schools and Murdoch University, it's great to see those kids showing the skills that they've got as well. So and it's a competition. So they were working hard at it.
At stud and upstud breeder Peter Milton speaking there with Tyne Logan, who's out at the Perth Royal Show over the next few days for the Country Hour. And a perennial grazing plant that's just been dubbed the holy grail of legume science could be commercially available to livestock farmers in just 18 months. Lebekia, which was sourced from South Africa about a decade ago by WA scientists, is a lot like lucerne. But it grows well, in terms of similarity, on poor, infertile, sandy soils. Professor John Howison from Murdoch University has spent years researching Lebekia and planting trial crops, which currently extend from Benu to the north and to Vass in the south. He told Tara de Landgraaft he believes it will be enormously beneficial to people farming on particularly arid and sandy land.
If you can get a well-adapted, grazable perennial legume on those soils, you can use them to lamb into or wean from in the summer months, get your vitamin E, and give you overall better carrying capacity for your flock because you've got green feed in summer. And I think in Western Australia, you could consider that to be a holy grail. And we'd like lucerne to do that, but it can only do that on a few soils. We're just unfortunate to have soils that are not friendly for lucerne, so it's really about finding a replacement or an addition to lucerne for those soils.
And a milestone with the first commercial harvest, I understand, as well.
Well, we're hoping to do... We've bought a little harvesting machine out of China that we think will do the job for our small plot work to harvest the seeds in December off the trial at West Corrigan at Richard Guinness's place. I would call it a pre-commercial seed harvest. So if we're successful this year and we get enough seed to put in a large sowing, that will be the beginning of the commerce of it. At this point in time, I've used all the seed for experimentation and we haven't set about establishing a paddock from which we can have a regular supply of seed. We're going to do that this year as well at Whitby Farm, which is a Murdoch-owned farm in Serpentine, and from there move into production of commercial quantities of seed. But yeah, I'd hope we'd be handing out some larger quantities of seeds by 2019.
So how exactly will it be sold, John?
Well, we're looking at a system now. It's another plant out of our stable of aerial seeding plants where we will encourage farmers to harvest and spread their own seed. So we've done that with the Ceridellas, Bizarrula, Bartolo, Prima Clover. This group of aerial seeding plants are fantastic for farmers to take up because they can grow a nursery paddock, harvest the seed and spread it. That system produces market failure in terms of a royalty return to the breeders, and that system essentially will not support the long-term R&D that a plant like Lebekia requires. We're talking a 10-year investment from Murdoch University to this point. So the commercialisation system I'm trying to develop is one based on an area-based return, a dollar a hectare a year over a contracted period of 10 to 20 years, I think will be the model we develop. So we'll sell seed at cost, an inoculant at cost, and encourage farmers to spread harvest, or to harvest and spread further. But there will be a contract whereby that provides a return to the breeding program for future work.
So not so much an endpoint royalty, but more, a licence, a fee?
Yeah, I just call it a per hectare royalty, because there's no way of producing an endpoint on animals or the nitrogen that you put in your cereal crops that you rotate. It's a the pasture science tends to fall between the cracks in terms of direct return on investment in say a breeding program. the economics of Lebbeckia adoption suggests it's worth $200 or $300 a hectare a year just for the benefits to your animal flock. So putting 1% of that, or a dollar a hectare, back into a breeding program doesn't sound like a big ask to me. But I'm putting that out there for people, and if they want to feed back their views on it, then I'm happy to receive them.
So why do you think that Lebbeckia is going to succeed where other plants have failed?
Well, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And so what we've found over the last series of trials is that if we get everything right, so if we establish the plant right, we control weeds, we control the tagazaste grub, which is the predator of it, and we manage the fertility of it properly, then the plant grows for 3 or 4 years and is highly productive. 10 times as productive as lucerne on these soils. So we've seen that in large plots, 1 hectare plots. And as you would know, if the plant survives and grows for that long, you have to accept that, okay, the plant is adapted. And the next challenge is, well, how do you get a benefit from it in the farming system? So we've had grazing trials which show the animals like the plant doesn't mind being grazed, so that just ticks another box. So I'm confident in the sense that everything we've thrown at it, the porous soils, non-wetting acid soils, low fertility, there's not a lot of nutrients on these soils that the plant can capture, drought and flood don't seem to have knocked it back. So I'm confident in the sense that we've gone to the point where now I'm giving interviews like this, confident that I'm not going to overhype the plant. And I didn't give interviews like this 3 or 4 years ago because I wasn't confident. So I'm happy to talk it up now. It doesn't mean it's going to be taken up widely because the seed increase challenges of all plants are high. I think we can get about 100 kilos per hectare off the sites we've got now. So the real challenge for commercialisation or adoption now is how quickly can we produce seed? And it takes 18 months after planting to get seed. So, you know, that's immediately going to slow you down.
Professor John Howison was speaking there with Tara de Landgraft. So how does Lebbeckia actually perform? Peter Cripps farms at West Benue, and he planted a quarter of a hectare of the legume in July last year. Peter, how has the crop established?
It took a week or two before we had a germination, and it was germinating quite well. But last year we were in the middle of shearing, and a frontal system was coming through. John originally wanted to plant the plot north-south, which is a no-no on our country out here with our southerly winds. And I got him to plant it, managed to convince him to plant it east-west. And lo and behold, if we didn't get a frontal system come through with a massive westerly wind and buried half the plot. But a lot of it has recovered. There's certainly a section of it that has struggled and still is struggling. And, from there, so-called tagazaste grub gave it a hiding at a couple of times, and sandplain grasshoppers have given it a bit of a belting. And in that 12 months of growing period, you know, we've sprayed that at least 3 times for insect control.
So despite all the weather factors and some of those environmental factors, have you been happy with how it's performed, Peter?
Certainly, yes. It's jumping out of the ground beautifully at the moment. Every plant's flowering and setting pods. Mind you, they have struggled because of the insect damage. John did encourage me to put sheep in it, which I did. And I sat there with my iPad trying to take a photo of them and watch them graze it. They wandered around it and sniffed it and whatever, but they just pretty much ate the annual grasses that were growing in amongst it. And then, because I had a couple of rows of Rigodia alongside it, and once they got the smell of the Rigodia and tasted that, they stampeded for that. So I had to end up eventually taking them out of the plot, and from there they haven't had sheep in it since.
And so what were the main teething problems, do you think, there? You mentioned pests, clearly the livestock not being too interested right now. What were the main factors for you that you might think you need to work on a bit?
Oh, good question. Certainly establishment is a bit of a concern, more so from the insect side of things. Tasting it yourself, it's a very bitter taste, so whether there's a time of year that's more suited to the sheep finding it palatable or not, it's another thing. But yeah, that's something we'll learn as time progresses. Certainly once the seed's been collected, we'll endeavour to put sheep on it and give them another go at it and see if they take the limiting factors I expect are establishment, in that it's very rhizobic Pacific. That's an issue, obviously. And it's got a huge, massive taproot on it. We dug a plant up and put into the Northampton 100-year show this year. And when the son and myself went and dug a plant up to put in a container, the root was boggling. It was a massive, big hunk of root system. We didn't get anywhere near the total depth of it. I'm led to believe that the taproot could go down to at least 3 metres, if not more. It's certainly going to, once it gets established, it will certainly take hold and be a forever plant, so to speak.
Well, at least it's not going anywhere. Peter Cripps, thank you so much for joining me on the Country Hour. It's 5 to 1. And there was a big crowd of fishos on the Ord River this weekend for the annual Barra Bash in the Kimberley. Competitor numbers were up on last year. The number of fish caught was up. And our very own Matt Brand once again caught nothing. But he thankfully packed his microphone and he caught up with those who enjoyed a bit more success.
G'day, Aaron McNamara here from Apex Cunnamulla. We just had our Apex Barra Bash on this weekend. It's been a great weekend. We had over 120 entries, 107 fish caught that were measured and entered into the competition. That was juniors and seniors, plenty of prizes won, and a great weekend had by all.
Did anyone catch a metre plus barramundi?
No, 950 was the biggest barra caught. We had a catfish come in just on 1 metre, so that was an absolute stonker of a catfish, I could say.
We'll go and catch up with that bloke in a moment. In general, what sort of weekend was it? What were people saying about the river?
I haven't seen, in my time in the Barra Bash, which is 5 or 6 years now, I haven't seen this many barra caught in this stretch of the river for any years that I've been here. So, yeah, to have 54 barra caught and so many more caught that were undersized that had to be thrown back, and people already had barramundi on the board, so they probably threw back plenty more.
G'day, how you going? It's Ian Lewis here at the Barra Comp. How are yous?
Ian, you caught a big fish today. Wasn't a barra, though. Tell us about it.
Yes, got one of them big river goats and caught a... Took a while to play it, bring it in, but yeah. Filled the esky.
Did you call it a river goat?
Yeah, big catfish.
Yeah, I think our audience will probably know it as a catfish. So it was a metre in length.
Yep.
Tell us about the fight.
had live bait and had it out there and got lucky, I suppose.
And are you taking it home to eat?
Yeah, for a fish, big boy.
I'm going to give it to my friends, and I'll swap it for some Asian tucker, I reckon.
That's the go. Well done. Normally catching a catfish is a bit of a bugger at the moment, but you've taken home some prizes. Well done.
Very good. Thank kindly.
Here with Robbie Cox, who caught the biggest barramundi of the weekend, 950 millimetres. Tell us about that catch.
Yeah, it was good. Pretty quiet for the whole day, and then... Yeah, waited for a couple of hours and, yeah, got a couple in a row. And then big girl come.
And tell us a bit about the fight. I'm sure you didn't just drag it in.
No, it was a pretty good fight. Nearly ended up dying, but, yeah, put her back and away she swam. Apart from that, it was a good weekend.
Well, you got the trophy, you got the prizes. Well done. Thanks for your time.
No worries. Thanks for that.
It's Robbie Cox. You've got to admire the... laid-back attitude, he says, with nearly ended up dying, who caught the biggest barramundi on the weekend at the annual Barra Bash on the Ord River. His barra was 94 centimetres, but also well done to Denisha Pete, who caught the biggest barra in the juniors section. Her barra was actually 91 centimetres, so only 3 centimetres off the biggest one caught for the main section as well. And there is, just to let you know, no Mouche cattle sale today due to the public holiday, but the nominations as at Friday afternoon show that there'd be a total of about 1,370 there tomorrow, if you can get along. And thank you to Mick on the text line, who says, with regard to the rainfall, Reed, must be on holiday in Denmark over 72 hours. Mick had 74 millimetres at his place. 47 millimetres of that was overnight until 9 a.m. this morning. I think Mick should probably just become our official Denmark rainfall correspondent. Thanks for your thoughts there, Mick. And thank you for your time today listening to me. It's been an absolute pleasure to be with you, and I will be back here with you tomorrow, where we will have the details of that market sale at Newshay. Time to get to the news now, though. It is 1 o'clock.